Welcome to Bet It Sports. I'm Richard Holland.
And I'm Duncan McKenzie.
And we have had a very exciting week. It was the opening of our Chicago Next Artropolis, which I can't believe they're still using because it's the worst name ever for anything. And we also got to tour the new wing of the Art Institute of Chicago. That will be coming up soon on the show. We went around with Assistant Curator for Contemporary Art, Lisa Doran. That was very exciting. But that's not what is running this week. Why don't you tell us what's running this week, Duncan?
Well, this week, Rochelle Feinstein. Rochelle Feinstein and I had a great conversation last time I was in New York, and she is an incredible painter and a great educator, and we have a chat about painting and teaching and audience, and it's awesome, and it's coming up. I am in the studio of Rochelle Feinstein. Welcome to Bad at Sports, Rochelle Feinstein.
Welcome to the studio.
Thanks. It's Rochelle Feinstein, a great New York painter, professor at Yale, won a couple of Guggenheim fellowships, charming conversationalist, and apparently mean and angry, depending on who you ask. You had a show maybe 8 or 9 months ago in Chicago at the Suburban, which is where we met. And it was this kind of lovely, the space was very dark. There was only a couple of light sources in it. There was a little kind of, what do we call it? Like a footstool with a little TV on it that was, it had a painting of a disco ball on it. And then over to the side, there was a series of kind of mirrored surfaces with little kind of inset mirrors. And then over them was painted Love is Over in a number of different languages, and they were turned on their side. And they kind of split out in a line. And then in the other corner, there was a disco ball chained to, I feel like it was a little black hat turned over. And it was kind of gleaming, but it was sort of chained in like a ball and chain, which I think might have been
that was the title.
Yeah. And I remember thinking, I remember sitting in there for like 15 minutes trying to figure out what was going on in the soap opera that was playing on the TV behind the kind of disco ball. And there was some sort of weird love triangle. I was trying to figure out who was in love with who and what was going on while it sort of shone out in this like twinkly disco ball way. And I thought it was really outstanding, and I thought it was, I really liked the way that it connected to a kind of glamorization of love and a question about like how we deal with it when it's over and the kind of desire and glamour that still remains in it. And I was excited to sit down and chat with you about it.
Well, you said very nice things about it.
Well, it was very nice.
Yeah.
How was my read on it? Is that
your read is... is very good, and particularly I'm really pleased that you stayed and you listened and watched while you listened.
Well, I'm a sucker for audio and romantic comedy, so I was like, what? She's cheating on him with who? Wait, is he cheating on her?
Was this in the, was it an English language or a Spanish?
It was an English language. Yeah. But I feel like when I walked in, it was in Spanish, and then it was English language, and I was like, wait, I can sit and participate in this.
Yeah.
But tell me a bit about the Love is Over part.
Yeah, the Love is Over part. It's I'm gonna work backwards.
Please.
I'll begin with Love is Over and then move backwards. I think that might get there a little bit. Begin with Love is Over. No, I'm gonna do it the other way around. All right.
I'm
going to begin with light, because when you first came in, I began talking about light and
the TVs
and the TVs and that. So I want to talk about light, and that I'm going to go back to something which is a project that I did that was never realized. And I spent 2 years working on the project, and went about it ass backwards because I created the whole project and then looked for a place to put it, which apparently is not the way things are done. But the other way things are not done is that the title of the project was "I Made a Terrible Mistake," and
kind of dooming yourself to failure at the outset.
Well, apparently so. And the expression comes from, well, it's said by many people, and but the one that triggered my response, or it made it a significant phrase to me, was when Michael Jackson dangled the baby out the balcony, and all he said afterwards it was, "I made a terrible mistake," without apologizing. So, of course, I realized how, I've not forgotten Love Is Over, by the way, how in the last 20, 30 years, I don't know how long, that the idea of an apology, an "I'm sorry," has a less and less kind of traffic in that "I'm sorry," and that one, politicians, movie stars, lovers, it become part of the language of redemption, is to say, "I made a terrible mistake," which is quite different than saying, "I'm repentant," or "I'm really sorry I did something bad." So I became interested in that, and also at the same time, not just because of its demotic meaning, which I'm very interested in. I've used language before. I don't really work in text. I normally work in words or just, you know, kind of vernacular phrases. And so I was interested in all as well, because what I do in my work that I feel like I do best is make mistakes and work with them. So I decided to begin a project that focused on doing things that didn't go together and then trying to rectify it or redeem them through the process of being an artist. Now, along the way, and that started probably in like 2002 or 2003, along the way, Barry White died. And I was also at Giverny. I had a residency grant through the Art Production Fund to spend time at Monet's gardens, in which I realized that those gardens were totally synthetic. And they every 3 weeks they change, you know, they rip the plants out and change the colors, and to, you know, they completely orchestrate a, you know, cascade of colors throughout the season. It was also the summer of the drought when all these people were dying in Paris, and they had to really have people visit, and but it was terrible to, you know, keep them alive and all that. But I started thinking when Barry White died, whom I was just nuts about his music and his story about, which was basically that he made mistakes, and the only way he became Barry White as we knew him is because nobody would publish him and nobody would sing his songs. It was too dangerous. You couldn't do that. And now they're played in banks and all over the place. I'm going on and on here. Tell me to stop.
No, please.
So I'm going to get around to Love Is Over. So I realized that being in this garden situation, that the mistake that Michael Jackson made, on the other side of that is the idea of redemption. Once he says, you know, he admits that he made the mistake, and Barry White offers redemption. And all of Barry White's songs are about redemption in the realm of romance, that there will be romance, there will be forgiveness, or forgive me. Never really says I'm sorry, not once in any of his songs. I listen to all of them. But then the notion of the disco came into play, and light and mirrored, and the mirrored ball. And it began this project of working with, the whole project took on five different kinds of lighting elements within it, which were related to painting light. Then there was light that's used in egg tempera, which is a very different kind of light, photographic light, cinematic light. I can't even remember, but they were, digital light. The thing is created only through filters, and then the disco ball itself as a, you know, refractory kind of constantly rotating element. So the Love Is Over elements grew out of the Barry White project, that part of the project. And how we ended up with the pieces in the Suburban, there's a longer road, but those pieces started with a very small hand-painted. I thought, what could be more kind of depressing than a flattened disco ball? So I, you know, Patty's Party Web is my supplier, and I, you know, shout out to Patty's Party Web in Treasure Island, Florida, and because the disco ball itself represents hope, and my idea is that it does represent the wish for transformation. It's not gone away. It's been around since the 20s, and it's optical, but it's also phenomenological. And the ball itself, you kind of go into this situation, no matter how hokey this place is, there's a disco ball, and if once you move in it, it's an invitation to feel transformed. And painting, to me, is a transformation, not transcendence, but a transformation of matter into other matter. So the flattened out pieces, Love is Over, really began with a small painting, which is actually over there. Somewhere there.
Yeah.
And I had the idea of then, and I was doing other work alongside that. There are other pieces which are hotspots, and I'd done pieces for every year, this kind of globe, which I could show you one and go into it if you want. But it's a large, enlarged disco ball that sort of represents the earth. And so the Love is Over, I thought, I'm very concerned with matters of the moment, of contemporary life. And that's one thing that I constantly keep going in the work in terms of an added subject matter to create new content. So I'm not an international artist. I'm a New York artist. I'm New York based. I'm a woman. I'm a woman of a certain age and feel pretty fine about it. And I've had a lot of experience, and I thought, well, what is my contribution to globalism? And when I thought about it, I realized that the lovers I've had in my life have been quite international.
I love that you've had a lot of experience. There was a euphemism for, I've been around the block a few
exactly.
times.
Exactly. Yes.
That was actually one of the things I really loved about that show, was this idea that, like, there was this kind of weirdly confessional, kind of vaguely melodramatic kind of experience with it. But it was still really bizarrely hopeful in a kind of funny way, where it was like, all these things have happened, but I still, like, it still could happen.
Yes. And it will, and it could, for everybody. I mean, it's sort of like my shout out. It's my shout out to globalism as a feminist. And in terms of my own personal politics, my sexual politics, but it's the mirror part. So I have two feelings about the mirror and the language, because you mentioned that they were on their sides, and this may have been apparent. And you can, you know, bounce this. I'd like to bounce this off you to see if this is something you got, because yeah. I think that when one looks in a mirror and you see yourself, You can't really believe things are over. You have to, one's ego has to in some way, whether you don't like your image or not, but you're looking at yourself, you can't say it's over. You're there. You're present. You're reflecting. You're being reflected. And in a way, it can't be over. There's always a little bit of, even if you have a conviction things aren't going to work out well, you might still have a little bit of hope. And that the language itself is all on its side, meaning that it's sort of like not effective. It's not vertical. It's not a statement, it's not an edict, it's kind of lame. It's not really over. It's sort of like disabled. The read of it is disabled. You end up looking at yourself as much as you do the language.
Yeah, it feels a lot less intrusive in terms of, like, the text isn't dominating us as a kind of person there.
Yeah. Well, the actual phrase, then, to return to the original part of it, comes from I began that little painting, Love is Over, when it was the anniversary, maybe last September or something, of, I don't know, the death of John Lennon, the birth of John Lennon, something. And that photograph of John and Yoko in that protest that they had in maybe 73, the war is over if you want it, and it was Merry Christmas. And I looked at the original photograph, and I thought, this is really familiar. And why? And now I started doing research, and it's the typeface and the phrase. That typeface and that phrase has been used, at least as far back in the research I went through, New York Magazine archives online. War is Over is a headline. It was a headline for, you name the war. War is Over, and it's always in that typeface. And I thought, perfect. Now I can really play with this, an idea of Love is Over, because war is never over, and love is never over.
Yeah, no. It's not. I saw Yoko Ono play last year.
Oh,
in Chicago, and she was still banging the words over drum. Like we all of us as the audience had to kind of like yell, "War is over if you want it," for a while, and we got to talk about how the Iraq War was insane, and then she made funny noises and talked about like what her life with John was like and what it was like to have her child like kidnapped. And it was a really weird concert because you're like, wait a minute, what the hell's going on? And then and the guy from Sonic Youth came out to play with her in the place.
Thurston Moore was there. Yeah.
And I was just like, this is the weirdest thing ever.
She's Fluxus.
Yeah.
Still. Yeah. She's very Fluxian.
Because she was a living embodiment of it.
Oh, yeah.
We used to call those people crazy before we called them Fluxus.
Oh. Well, I've been actually looking at some of them, and, it wasn't actually Fluxus, but there's an artist who's really, I've seen do a performance when I was at Bard one summer doing the graduate program, which is terrific there, and they had a woman there who should be much more widely known than she perhaps is, but she did a lot of endurance performances. And her name is Linda Montano. And she did a performance in which she had participants. We were all there, the graduate students of the faculty. It was like, 250 people. And we didn't know what was happening. And we didn't know whether it to be terrified or to laugh or to cry or to flee. And we had no idea when it would end. And it was phenomenal. And she's still at it, doing it, and in a very different way, but still the spirit of it is appropriate to this moment.
Yeah, and I should correct this because somebody's going to email me and be like, Fluxus artists aren't crazy, fuck you. So I didn't mean Fluxus was crazy. I meant Yoko Ono was crazy, and I'm going to stand on that one.
Oh, that's
that's my assertion, and I'm sticking to it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that was really far out. But I actually want to return from one pop celebrity to another and talk about Michael Jackson for a second.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think... why were we so outraged that he held this... Like, yes, it shows a reckless abandon for his child's life, but why does that bother me? Like, why do I care what Michael Jackson does? He's like... We've more or less caught him kid-diddling a couple of times, and we keep letting him off. Like, it's... When he hangs his baby out of a window in a funny mask, like, well, this just seems like the icing on the cake. Like, why do we demand that he say he's sorry and, like, come out and express some sort of, like, well, I made a mistake kind of logic?
Yeah. I think everything else was, no one was witness to. The diddling, whether it was... Macaulay Culkin years ago or whoever the children are now. It's like no one was there when OJ allegedly
may or may not
his
have
wife
murdered
and,
his
and,
wife
and
her friend
and Ron Goldman. That's all hearsay. And I think that Michael Jackson is such a huge celebrity and means so much to so many people who are, nutty fans. They talk about crazy. But I think there was evidence right in front of your eyes of something that was so extraordinarily stupid. Just the pure stupidity. What you may have even suspected, the way in which his kind of, whether you call it innocence, naivete, his playfulness, it all sort of came out in that you can't be playful in dangling a child. No one could deny that was so dumb. And it was something that it was, unforgivable for that reason. Oh, and he also, by the way, it said that some of the reports, I investigated this, and some of the reports said that because there were throngs of people down there saying, Michael, we love you. And that he just to give a shout out, he brought the baby out and did this. But apparently there were like 14 people there. and that to me is the really sad part, that the need for attention,
the throbbing masses
is like 14 people. And just for that he went through all that, and that was the beginning of the end. That was when he had to kind of then seek redemption of some sort.
I don't think his redemption is coming. I don't. We seem to. I like that his music is back somehow. Like, all is forgiven. Like, every once in a while now, I hear Michael Jackson in a way that we didn't hear it before. And like 3 or 4 years ago, you wouldn't hear anyone playing it at a wedding. Yes. But now he's back. We're blaming it on the boogie all again.
Well, that, I was. Well, it, we are. but I wanted to find a way, because the whole thing is celebrity is so synthetic anyway. That I love the notion of Barry White sort of redeeming you know, one pop musical culture, which is really not about which is really about mostly, I think, all heterosexual relationships. There are other things it's about, but I mean that voice. I mean, everything is registered. His voice registers on a, if you kind of lay it out, and you guys probably have the equipment to do it. But if you graph it, and I did because I did this white on white CD, so I kind of graphed. You know, I just like screwing around with a garage band or something.
Yeah.
But his voice is so deep. You know, it's lower than a bass guitar. It's his such a low sound, and it just, it's guttural, it goes somewhere. And Jackson is the very opposite. So
one's all subwoofer, the other's all tweeter.
Is that how you'd say it? Yeah.
I sort of brought up Michael Jackson for another reason, and this idea that, like, we would learn to apologize without actually taking responsibility for our mm-hmm. actions in this very kind of surface way. Like, I know I have to apologize about this, but I don't really think I was responsible for it. So I'm going to try and make nice
mm-hmm.
by claiming a portion of responsibility without actually kind of acknowledging a failing here. And I kind of liked the idea that that's sort of a much bigger kind of stream in your work, that like there are always these references to these very kind of surface ways of talking or kind of saying something that you maybe mean, but you don't, you're not really thinking about it well enough to really kind of mm. earnestly mean it.
Mm.
And I feel like it's exactly like the mirrored ball, like yeah. the idea that this is a kind of stand-in for desire and glamour, but it's this very kind of silly and cheesy, and like we all know how kind of hokey it is, but we are willing to kind of suspend that so that we can participate, like in that that painting of yours that says the word bubbles, and one says like love you, like as though yeah. you were saying I love you,
yeah.
And the one next to it says love your work, and then you're like, oh, it's actually love your work, which mm-hmm. it sounds like the thing that we say all the time, and sometimes we mean it, and sometimes we mean, hey, you're a good person, and keep on trucking, but love is a strong word here, but right. I'm gonna go with it,
yeah.
And I love the idea that it was this kind of like very kind of like, you know, kiss on the cheek, love you, see you later kind of thing yeah. that I feel like you often come back in the language that you use in painting.
Yeah.
That there's always this kind of strange connection, and you move through the different kind of vernaculars of painting really well. Like you move through kind of yeah. text painting and abstract painting, but then you also did a kind of large series of egg tempera, like traditional, like high rendered realist paintings,
right?
As though you could operate inside of the language in any way you wanted.
I feel that way, and that's not. I hope it doesn't sound like hubris on my part, but I will talk a little bit about.
I'm a hell of a painter.
I'm a fucking
bitches.
I'm willing to take it on. I really am, because I came up at a time sort of when it was you know. Either painting was bad, or it was dead, or it was had to look a certain way, or you had to be in or out. My work never really fit that mold, but that was a conscious decision on my part. I really, really love painting, and I don't like to look at a lot of painting right now. And so, you know, that's just it. There's just not a lot that there's a lot I'm indifferent to, because I don't think that It's the painting that I'm thinking of is very repetitive. It repeats a history. It goes to a layered history, which we all know that exists through language. And if it can be, if a contemporary painting can be connected to some painting from 15 or 20 years ago, and that builds on that language, well, then we have a good painting, particularly in abstraction, that's the case. Much more so than representation. I mean, that's representation has a tendency, I think, to be less routine. It's adventurous in other ways, and that has to do with an association with a figure. Abstraction's, for me, the most challenging thing to think about. And the paintings as egg tempers were all based on representations, and I was interested in working non-narratively by using pictorial language. And using light to point to the fact that there is no subject matter, because we read light as a spotlight. But more important than that, the way those that love your work, I want to talk about that Love Your Work series,
yeah.
and because the idea of love comes up again and again, and because it's a very strong feeling. So I had for years been, when I first started out at as an artist, I've always worked discreetly. That is, I really have a very strong belief that my desire has been to make each painting specifically address what it's about. Whatever that, whether it's one painting came out of me having a, you know, a booked up address book, and it was called Miss Busy, and because somebody said, "Aren't you Miss Busy?" I thought, that's a great premise for a painting. How do I make a busy painting? I mean, I just look for clues from the world. So when people used to say, or dealers would say, and they don't say it anymore because they just know this is what I do, but they would say, "Well, that's really great. Now, can you just do like five more like that, and then we have a show?" And now that's an honest response. I think that's fine. Then there were people that would come in. This is early on, in the 80s, in the mid-80s. Then people would be completely puzzled by what I was doing, where there was this kind of difference from piece to piece, although the grid, a kind of a modernist kind of infrastructure, kind of held the whole kind of gestalt together, but for me, but not for other people, apparently. And so I noticed that often when people would come in and they were mystified, they would just politely say, "Love your work." And the more that happened, the more I realized I was going nowhere with these people. So as soon as I would hear this phrase, I'd keep having people in. It was different in the 80s, mid-80s, when you had people to use studio. It was a much smaller, easier world to navigate, and a little friendlier, and not as much money involved. And so I realized as soon as somebody would say, "Love your work," that I would say, this isn't going well for me. And I'd say, "Oh my God, I forgot I had a dentist appointment." Or I would just say something. I'd say, "I'm so sorry, I have to cut this short." And and for years I was thinking about how at shows you go to an opening and people say, "I love your work," or "love your work." And it has a meaningless, meaningful sound. And I'm interested in misunderstandings and failures and mistakes in my work, because I'm a real fuck up in life, you know. And so I want my work to be as close to my life as possible. So the Love Your Work came out of what I began to feel that I could make a serious joke. I'm Jewish, maybe it's something to do with my Talmudic joke nature, where things keep going or spinning around. But I thought there were it's one of the three great lies, and you know the jokes. Right? The three great lies are, one is the check is in the mail, and the other is, "I won't come in your mouth, I promise." And then the third one, for my art world version of it, is "Love Your Work." So I ended up making 9 paintings. I spent a year working on that bubble, because the way in which we learn about art is through language. Even the art that we look at now, right? The layering of critical language, of historical language, of all of that. And so I made this font which read backwards, as if to see through that phrase, "Love Your Work," to look at something, which actually was an image. It wasn't a picture of anything, but it was a green painting on a wall, basically. And it moved architecturally or perspectivally, that the bubble was either fully red or partially red, or is up, down. It moved in all these different directions based upon where one might be standing in a room and in what directions you were casting your eye. So I was thinking about where what would be of interest to look at, which, you know, love your work while you're not even looking at the painting. So the bubble would be down at the bottom. So that's that's the origin of this kind of strange elision of stuff, I guess, in that work.
No, that's funny, because I had wondered about that when I was looking at those paintings, and I was like, so there's this big painting, and then there's a little tiny painting right beside it, and why break up the space that way? Like, what, you know, aren't you just bringing us down to that? Like, it's kind of, now I'm ignoring this painting to concentrate on the language in this one, and now I know. It's because I wasn't really looking at the painting anyway.
Well, I don't know if that meant it worked or not, but it could have been a failed, you know, attempt on my part at addressing how we perceive work, and I don't mind that. I mean, it was a big investment on my part, but.
But the question, I mean, I would be reluctant to call it a failure there, because I think that, like, ultimately, you're using the art world as subject matter, right? Like, our
yes.
experience of an artwork becomes your subject matter.
Yeah.
And then you make an artwork that kind of inflects that mm-hmm. very successfully. So that's not really a... That's just kind of a smart skewering. Although, it's... You could
well, thank you for that.
That, like, you know, this painting, the big painting, doesn't get as much attention because the little painting's distracting us. But, you know...
Is the bubble, yeah.
What are you going to do? Big dogs don't get as much attention when there's a little cute dog right
yeah.
beside it.
Well, I really wanted to think about a viewer. People often talk, I know I teach and you teach, and students at a certain level are concerned with one, not one thing, but one thing that has repeatedly come up, certainly in the beginning of every term, particularly with graduate students. Anytime you talk about anything and the idea of audience comes up, who is your audience? Have you noticed this?
Well, actually, I think that's a dramatic improvement from when, 10 years ago when I was, 8 years ago when I started my MFA program, because it was, because if you said audience, people just like cut off your fingers, like, fuck you, you're not a purist, like, die. But now I feel like it's okay to kind of acknowledge the fact that you want to have somebody look at your painting.
That's what that means, is like, who am I engaging with? And then it leads to other questions, is why am I doing something that's so difficult for the population one would want as an audience perhaps to understand. So my way of dealing with that is to, and I had this discussion actually with Todd Solondz. We invited him. I was doing something with Greg Crutzen, and we did this panel on contemporary narrative and contemporary art, and so people were asking Todd about his films, and particularly Suburbs, and how he felt about them, and then the question became one of audience. Now he's a filmmaker, he has an audience, and he was answering all the questions very wonderfully, really, really paying attention to what they were asking, and exactly what you're talking about is that concern for that. And he's a filmmaker, so he does. There is an audience that's different to consider. And then he turned to me and he said, "Rochelle, what do you think about your audience?" And I said, "Well, I think I have a viewer."
Let me talk about that bunch of fucking wankers. Open your goddamn wallets, people.
That's a viewer. That's an individual, right? But that's a viewer. So I really feel that for me as a painter, I cannot really address the audience. I address a viewer. That's what I think I'm doing. And the viewer there may be a commonality amongst viewers. I don't know if I would call it quite an audience for me. And I'm not negatively inclined to the word, but the word often implies for me something that doesn't exist as a painting. It's often outside. It's in the realm of durational art, or I think those are. It's a useful term in relation to that work, which is more audience oriented. But I really feel like I'm just got a pair of eyeballs looking at my work.
But I sort of think that's really fair. Like the idea of I'm kind of two minds on it. So, and no one on earth cares what I think, but I'm going to tell you anyway.
I care.
I sort of think that. Audience demands a kind of performative action, right? Like mm-hmm. that there be something performed and we kind of share an experience of it. Whereas as paintings and pictures have always seemed to demand a kind of like unique one-to-one mm-hmm. relationship that you would have you would give yourself over to it
yeah.
and you would have this experience because you gave yourself over to it, or you were allowing yourself to kind of really participate in the world that the picture was building.
Right.
But I think that we use audience also now in a sense of like, well, is this painting sort of more geared to the academic set to, you know, want to kind of wax philosophically about it? Or is it geared to kind of the humor set where it's kind of like cleverly satirizing the world that it's living in? So it's mm-hmm. kind of participating in mm-hmm. both an illustrative history and an art history and connecting with those people. Or is it kind of sort of a generalist picture that like you're making like things that could kind of communicate more broadly? Or how do you understand your task?
Sorry.
You have a cute little bird call for your phone ring.
Yeah, I know. If I know people, it's the bird, because it's such a nice sound. If I don't know people, if they're not in the bank, then it's a harp. It's very gentle. Yes. This is very gentle.
That's good, because whenever my phone rings and it's a number I don't know, I think like, oh God, what is this? And I'm either super positive that day, and I'm like, oh, it could be you know, the next great opportunity. Or I'm terrified and I'm like, oh, what do they want from me? Like, oh, what love do I have left to give people?
Yeah, I just know how to be cautious.
Yeah.
I try and protect as much as possible.
And fair enough.
So that's somebody I know, by the way. But back to this point. Go on.
And I feel like it's weird that we now, because I see it also as an acknowledgement that we are no longer cultural producers in a way that we used to identify ourselves. Mm-hmm. Like the loss of the avant-garde has had a kind of larger repercussion in that we no longer understand our task as a kind of communal task. I don't feel like most of us actually believe that the art we make connects with everybody. It seems to be for a very exclusive, sometimes elite, sometimes just damn insular mm-hmm. kind of audience. Mm-hmm. And that kind of worries me. I feel like we no longer are, or we've lost a kind of seat at a table. So I'm sort of two minds on that academic question or how to deal with that teaching wise. Because I feel like on one level, I do believe that students need to start thinking about like how they want to participate in the world. And that's a kind of audience question. Yeah. But on the other hand, I also want them to kind of be like, no, I'm making this special, like, fetishist object, and it needs to be awesome. And, like, I'm going to think about one person seeing it because I'm one person seeing mm-hmm. it and making it.
Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful, I'm going to misquote here, but first, a lot of audience, just in my general kind of feeling is that an audience can be very general. And broad, or it can be based upon stylistic choices or taste. You could call it taste, someone's taste. It can also be based upon one's experience. You know, at what level of experience, you know, other than taste, how does one approach a painting, or how does one approach a video, the expectation of what, you know, video, even in terms of length or narrative or... But for me, what was very, very important, I guess this is what I mean by viewer. It doesn't just mean one viewer, but I think the problem is larger, and I don't think it's my problem right now. I think it's a problem for a generation who's working with high-speed information and the information which is basically all screened information, that to look at a picture of anything is very slow. And it requires a certain kind of patience to look at that thing that doesn't move. That it has to have, it has to resonate not just with the eyeball and not just with taste, and I'm going to go to Michael Baxendall here, who recently died and who I thought was an extraordinary art historian. And for me, when I was quite young, well, first, my first art history class I ever had, it was like I was going to school at night, and it was this amazing class because I thought I was going to studying art history. In the first class, we received this book, a novel, Memoirs of Hadrian by Marguerite Yourcenar. And that was our text for the class. And I thought, oh my God. I was going to school at night. I was like 20 or 21. I was working during the day. I said, why am I reading this book? And it made me realize that something that I didn't know about, because the book is extraordinary. I don't know if you've ever read it, and it's really worth reading. And there are two things that changed my life as a young artist, or I didn't even know I was an artist then. I was an illustrator, and the realization I had in reading that book is that the construction of culture is a vast template. Whether it's through the economy or warring states, certainly at that time, religion, how religion functions in terms of government at that point, or institutions which govern people and who are the people and where they come from, certainly at that point. But what is an expression of all that? Certainly in talking when she's talking about Hadrian. Is the production of architecture and art. And I had the realization that art actually is part of history. I had no idea, that it was in synchronization with it. That it didn't exist purely as an art for art's sake, but that it could actually be a part of what was going on in the world. Then the second part is I later read, not too long after that, Michael Baxendall's book on painting and experience in, I think it's 15th century Italy. And he just begins at the introduction in which he talks about the viewer then, who is looking at the art and who's making the art. But he's most known for what he's written about in combining iconography together with a kind of more Marxian view of capitalist forming how things get made. So how much something costs and how that gets, a cultural producer would make that. So Giotto would use lapis, etc. But for me, the section that's really interesting in the introduction is about culturally relative skills, and that each person has two sets. There's kind of cognitive skills, they can think, and they have perceptual knowledge. And two things you bring together. And the perceptual knowledge is, I've looked at something before, I can look at it again, and I can understand it because, I've seen that. And then the culturally relative skills are what you may know. And I realized when I started out making these weird paintings that had to change from time to time, and which is my realization. There's going to be a lot of editing out here because it gets very funky, is that if someone looked at a grid, they would know that's a modernist painting. It's related to Mondrian. It's related to this. It's related to that, whatever. It's riffing off some earlier modernist structure, or suprematism, or constructivism. At the same time, there are things which exist in life, which are squares that are made. They're woven, they're functional, a newspaper gets laid out, it was then, leaded, and everything gets laid out. But we define them, one is aesthetic and the other is inesthetic or non-aesthetic. And my idea then was to try and bring the two things together in such a way that the person who could perceive of the grid could also perceive of the difference from the grid, and introduce another element of kind of, just stupidly say, the vernacular or daily life into something. And I think that was for me the main... those two things, that reading about art as being part of everything else, just a thing. And so the viewer that I'm going to go back to is the one that can recognize where I stay on the path of what's familiar and where I go off that path, and might be able to ask the question, what does that mean when things are off? What does that mean to me when they're off?
Well, I don't know what it means to me yet.
Yeah.
But I like the idea that we would still have some sort of agency in life. And I feel like this is a question that I've been kind of interested or concerned about over the last few years, where it starts to feel like art is more and more separate from life. That, more and more when you go to Venice or you go to the big international art shows, a lot of the work just feels dislocated, or it feels like it's trafficking in some kind of celebrity system. And it always bothers me because there are very few, I feel like, good artists out there who want to kind of connect back to our experience of life. You mentioned Gregory Crewson earlier, whose photos I really love, but the ones that I really love are the ones that like are kind of trafficked in that same sort of Jeff Wall narrative, where it's like they're scenes and you kind of sympathize with them and you recognize them. Mm-hmm. And they're not yet quite too sci-fi and they're not quite too constructed, but they're constructed, but they feel like they're real. And there's this sort of push-pull between your life and the image.
Yeah.
And paintings I connect with more are ones that, and the reason that your show spoke to me when we were in Chicago was that I recognize that, right? Like I recognize that moment of dislocation where you kind of want to feel deeply about something, but you sort of know that it's okay because you're just going to move on and you want to be real upset, but you can't be, but you are. And there's this sort of like awkwardness, right? And, you know, just like the mirrored ball where you want it to be glamorous. You know it's not, but you let it be. And I love those moments. And those are the moments I look for in
work
consumption.
Yeah. Yep.
And they feel rarer and rarer to me now.
I can say, honestly, I agree. Because we go out hungrily looking. We,
the rabid viewer.
Yeah, that's it. Not the audience, the viewer. For me, in that piece in the Suburban, and it was a way of really talking to an individual because it's such a small space. It's so intimate. There are no windows. The world is out there. You know, it's outside. It's no window. That's it. And you got to, like, deal with yourself in that room with all this cultural information. I love that. I mean, I went around to look at shows yesterday, I went around with a fantastic artist named Sarah Oppenheimer, and we're different generations, and we just ran around. You know, we began in Greenwich Village, and then we, you know, ran across town, and there was actually looking for an experience, and some people can do it very well. There's a show right now. I don't know if you're headed down to look at any work, but it's at Michelle Macaroni, and it's quite rather interesting because the guy's working with materials, which it's sculpture, I guess, but they're really sculpture. They're materials from the environment, but he stresses them. He stresses them out in a way which I can't even describe. But you get really a feeling of something has happened, some event has happened, and it's important. The more you look at it, the more it engages with the space that it's in. And it just is a really satisfying experience. The Jeff Wall thing, there's an artist up now in Chelsea, and I forgot his name. It was reviewed in Time Out. Luke something. It's Luke Mann. Maybe you can find it.
Maybe.
I don't have Time Out here.
Whose gallery was it at?
It's on 24th Street, and it might be Barbara Gladstone.
Oh, I didn't go in there.
It's somewhere on 24th Street, or it's not Andrea Rosen. It's not. It might be Barbara Gladstone. But it's extraordinary because it's really about the act of observation. The more you look at those large-scale photographs, you have to start thinking about, how did he do these? Where was he? Where was the lens? Because it's basically like a single bird. Everything else is kind of out of focus. The bird is in focus. And it's a huge landscape, huge expanses. And you really, it's an extraordinary exhibition. I didn't know his work at all, but it's the kind of thing that actually said, okay, here I am as an object. I am a large-scale photograph. It's almost like inviting you to be part of the picture in the way in which it operates, that you have to bring your experience of being on a site to looking at the photograph. Like, where am I? How do I understand this? And I think that's part of it. So for me, that makes me happy. When I find that,
sounds good. I'm going to be in Chelsea in a couple hours. So
it's listed in Time. I think Time Out gave it a little note. It's quite interesting, I think.
Now it's my turn for my cell phone to ring.
Yeah, make a note.
What's my?
With your phone. Where are we?
So we probably have another 5-6 minutes.
Okay.
What else should we hit?
Let's hit it. What, this.
Okay.
Language.
Okay, Rochelle, tell me a little bit about this, this sort of giant three-part painting that we're sitting beside, because one sort of takes the guise of, kind of very textual painting with this, color field painting reference in the back. And then you've got kind of a realist painting of like looking at a sky through from here sort of looks like a bullet-strewn window.
That's what it is.
And then you've got this sort of like gold and silver leafed abstract piece, and they're all kind of slammed together as one big piece. Yeah.
This is good for like a last thing. Nobody on radio can see it, so it's fabulous, folks out there. It's really fantastic.
It's the most amazing painting ever. <It's> like,
but each part is different than the other. And the whole piece developed. I work a lot in multiples of diptychs, triptychs, etc. And that one I'm working on, it's called Are We Depressed Yet? And it's not quite right. It has a way to go. But that one, it starts with a quote, and this is where I'm going to get to the viewer and the world, okay? And I think it's relevant just to talk about something no one can see, just so it continues this conversation about looking. And the quote I read, and it's from a wonderful South African photographer named Soletje Mtetwa. He's from Cape Town or Johannesburg, I can't remember where, but he does very large-scale, amazing photographs of individuals in fields. That's all I can say about it. People can look further. And so the two plaques on the left are one is his name spelled correctly, and the second one is an incorrect spelling. But the quote is, "Art in our day is not done for art's sake. It questions issues related to global processes." I have to get there and see it. "Such as urban industrialization, contemporary culture's identity crisis, gender, race, and social imbalance." That was just the quote I read. And I thought it's relevant. It's what every artist is thinking about in terms of who are they talking to, what are they talking about, and what are the larger global concerns that artists, maybe not all have, but many do, and particularly many younger artists of your generation, the one up and coming.
And Sarah's.
And Sarah's, exactly. Let me turn this way. Okay, nice. Here I go. So I wanted to also, because I am a painter, I don't want to be left out of the equation here. And so, as in, you know, like love in 14 languages of my ex-lover, my nod to globalism, you know, through my vagina. But it's like, so.
Genitals as foreign relations tool.
Exactly. I mean, no one ever talks about how the world is changing through fucking, except now. Now that we have, I mean, there's much, the idea of diversity is completely changed with Obama, and it's so interesting. So anyway, so I thought, well, how do I engage with that statement as a painting and really make it read as a serious statement? It's not a parody of the statement. And so I reshuffled the language so that I used a kind of a poster style from the 60s, you know, 60s rock and roll poster or yep. taco stand or something like that in the cheapest possible color, which is basically the standard printing color. So I used that as the basis of it, then reconfigured the words. So a viewer reading it wouldn't just say, oh, yeah, I know that, but really slow down and read it.
Yeah, you got to work through because the letters are slammed together awkwardly and then broken up awkwardly and fall over different lines and all types at sort of at different scales.
Yeah, and it's also the classic typeface from the 60s and, you know, a political protest and blah, 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 and all that stuff. And so it started out there, and that really, those two squares really were places where photographs would be in terms of an advertisement, you know, a flyer, a handbill. And then the second painting is actually an earlier painting. It was earlier than the one on the left. And it's taken from an image, the first image I saw in 2005, taken from inside a windshield in Fallujah. And I kind of expunged all the people and the debris and everything from the background of it and wanted to, in that idea of transformation, almost make it, I mean, both horrifying and beautiful at the same time. I mean, I think that a painter can, you know, move a lot of different directions.
Yeah.
So the graphical mode in the one sense, and I thought that it was actually a response or a pendant to that one for me. This is the way, you know, I kind of construct my work. So what would make you think about those issues? And there was the painting, which does.
A real confrontation with the consequences.
Yeah, and it does. And then the third element of it, I've been working with gold and silver laws, reflective surfaces, but they also have iconographic and iconic meaning and capital. So I leafed it, and it began to feel like a strange, unfinished map. It felt like a number of different things, I perceived it. And what I liked about it in terms of the three is, and the reason I left it, I could not touch it with paint, and I thought about it for a long time, is because it's an image, not a picture. It's something that can be projected upon too. And it offers a kind of non-pedagogical kind of approach at the end of it, but it also is the shredding of the gold and the silver. It signifies something.
Yeah.
Now, the first two parts of it, the plaque maker misspelled the name. and so that, to me, that's how global we are. And so he offered me the misspelled one also, because he called me to say, is that the way you spell it? I said, no, it's not. So he did that. He gave me that. And then I came back and I realized that I misspelled a word when I was doing it. Because being a painter, focusing on the little individual unit, I said process SSS. So I thought there was a nice kind of match between us. And then the whole piece is named The Little Engine. And The Little Engine was it was a childhood book I had, and it was written in the 1920s. And it's really about modernism. And that little engine who couldn't, always, the little engine was struggling to be the big engine, couldn't do anything, couldn't move along the track, and it's a parable of modernism, because finally, of course, the little engine
does.
And this is really the opposite of that. It's really the failure. so it's called The Little Engine.
That runs into a wall.
And it became an engine because of the three pieces. So, yeah, so that's sort of the story of that and how these things sort of, I'm trying to pull together different things. And they may not look like they work together, but to me, they think together.
So just as a last note here,
yeah.
This thing that you referred to as, I forget what the title was, but it was about...
Are we depressed yet?
It's like the most like super colorful, like frenetic piece, like... floating around in all sorts of different directions,
yeah.
And got all these like lovely, shiny, bright colors. I don't think we're depressed yet.
That's okay.
Although we might be chemically enhanced.
I'm fighting with it. Yeah, right. Thank you. That's a wonderful note. Yes, we are chemically enhanced.
Rochelle, thank you so much.
Thank you, Duncan. Thank you so much.
So we'll see you sometime soon.
Yes.
Don't even feel it, but Lord, how I need it. When I'm not with her, I'm not all myself. Sometimes have my breakfast right off of a mirror, and sometimes I'll have it right out of a bottle. Come on, I'm gonna rip it up, tear it out, gotta get it off of my soul.
That was Bad at Sports. I'm Richard Holland.
And I'm Duncan McKenzie.
And Bad at Sports would like to thank the following people for all of their assistance and guidance. Christopher Hudgens, Serena Worthington, Lauren Vallone, Elena Stern, Audrey Mast, Robert Jacoby, Meg Only, Tim Ridlin, Claudine Issei, Mike Benedetto, Terry Griffith, Joanna Topor McKenzie, Lori Waxman, Catherine Bourne, Lisa Boyle, Amanda Browder, Tom Sanford, Nathan Rogers Madsen, Brian Andrews, Patricia Maloney, Matthew Nash, Mark Staff Brandel, Emily Heath, Christian Curis, Steve Hammond, Joseph Trupia, and Duncan would like to say his own personal thanks to Joseph Mohan. If you'd like to contact us, you can do so at badatsports@gmail.com. You can leave pithy messages on our blog at badatsports.com. You can click and make a PayPal donation using the donate button on the front page. And that's it. Anything clever to say, Duncan?
No, not really.
All right, then.